Good morning and welcome to this live webinar and Q&A on the BIS's FX Global Code of Conduct, the full and final version of which has been released this morning. My name is Eva Salehi and I'm the editor of FX Week. I'll be your moderator today for this session, which we will start with a brief conversation around the main issues and then we'll go into live audience questions. We would like to devote the majority of our session today to live to your questions, so please start sending them in as soon as possible. Now, I'm glad to say that we have quite a good panel lined up for you today. To my left is Simon Potter, the leader of the workstream tasked with drafting the code and the head of the markets group at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. We have Guy DeBell, the chair of the Bank for International Settlements FX Working Group and the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Chris Salmon, the leader of the workstream in charge of developing adherence to the code and the Bank of England's executive director for markets. And we have David Puth, the leader of the market participants group and contributing to the BIS FX Working Group and on the FX Global Code of Conduct and the CEO of CLS. Now, unfortunately, before we start, on a slight housekeeping note, David will have to leave 10-15 minutes early to catch a flight. So if you have any questions specifically directed to him, please send them in now. Now, I'd like to come to you, Guy, first. What have you been doing in the past 2 years?
So over the past 2 years, we've put together this code of conduct for the FX market. The reason why we've been doing so is to address the issues which were evident in the market prior to that point and a collective desire to move the market to a better place. So over the past few years, we've developed this code. It sets out principles of good practice in the foreign exchange market to provide a common set of guidance to the market to enable it to move, to restore confidence and promote the effective functioning of the market. What is the code? That is the code. The code has 55 principles. It covers all aspects of the wholesale foreign exchange market. It is a code for all participants in the wholesale foreign exchange market. It's not just there for the sell side, it's there for the buy side, for platforms, for ECNs, non-bank liquidity providers, all people who engage in the foreign exchange market. As I said, it articulates a common set of guidance as to what is good practice in the market. Alongside that code, today we have also put out a blueprint on the various mechanisms we have around or have developed around achieving adherence to the code.
Over the past 2 years, have you ever woken up in a cold sweat and said, this is not regulation?
No, it's always, I've never slept, so I haven't had to wake up over the past 2 years. But it isn't regulation. This is voluntary. The one key aspect of this which I should emphasise, and it's reflected by David sitting here today, is that this is a public-private initiative. It is not regulation. It is a voluntary code. And I have every confidence that it will be successful in achieving what we've set out to do. I said, I think one important aspect of it is its public-private initiative, you know, involving large swathe of market participants from right across the market alongside the central banks.
And finally, before I come to you, Simon, why did you decide to go down the route of principles rather than regulation?
So from my point of view, I've said this plenty of times before, including at FX Week events, I think principles are the more precise and more detailed you get, then I don't think it achieves what we had set out to do, and for a couple of reasons. Principles actually make you think about what you're doing, whereas if it's very rules-based, then you tend not to think, and it's just a box-ticking exercise. Whereas principles mean you actually need to think about what it is you're actually doing in your engagement in the market and whether or not it's appropriate. So to put it in a market vernacular, I think rules are much easier to arbitrage than principles. And so at the outset, and also reflecting the fact that it is a voluntary code, that's why we went down the route of principles-based code rather than a rules-based code. The other thing I would note is that with rules-based, if you don't cover it, then it's not clear what is the appropriate behaviour. With principles, I think you can cover a wider swathe of behaviours and articulate what it is you're actually trying to achieve here.
And I guess, as you said, you know, it requires that people understand what they're doing rather than just follow a box-ticking exercise.
Yeah.
So, Simon, you were in charge of writing the code, and boy, there were some, you know, storms around particular words, and I guess there were some issues to overcome as well in terms of writing a code for a global audience who's, you know, a lot of the people who will read it and who it will apply to. English is not their first language. Could you talk us through first of that challenge? You know, how easy / difficult was that for you to do? And then if we could come to this whole word likely and talk about that a little.
Thanks. So there are 55 principles there, as Guy said. And some of the principles were pretty easy to construct from the codes that were there. Other principles, we had to think really hard. And there was a very rigorous procedure for that, involving market participants from all over the world, central banks, feedback. We'd have many feedback rounds. Overall, we had over 10,000 comments on different drafts of the code. And that really helped us refine in particular areas where the market needed help understanding aspects of certain ways they were executing, what governments would do. And I found, and this is true in other work I've done on best practices, where you get to a point where there's disagreement amongst market participants, and it can be between the sell side or between the sell side and the buy side, that's usually where best practices can do their best work. And we saw that trying to really clearly define what a principal was versus an agent. There's a lot of discussion at the start about riskless principal, which is a term that might translate well in some languages, but was meaningless in others. So in principle 8, we try to be really clear about the difference between principal and agent.
So very clear definitions rather than...
Very clear that market participants should know which role they're acting in. And if they are to act in a principal role, there is some discretion that they have. And they should be doing it in a way that's not designed or intended to disadvantage the other counterparty that they're dealing with. That was a large discussion, I think a very useful debate we had through the first phase of the code. Now, clearly in the second phase of the code, a lot of people have focused on Principle 17, which is around last look. This is a relatively newer way of executing in FX markets. And one of the things I noticed as we built up this quite lengthy principle is a really good debate where we were able to be precise about what last look was. So as the code makes clear, last look is a risk control device. It's really why it's in there. And then there are certain aspects of that where we want to see great care being taken. And in particular, we want to understand the people who are getting last look, that they understand what care has to be taken. And there was a particular feature there where some of what we some approaches to last look involve trading the last look window subsequent to the client request of interest. And we looked at that quite carefully. Clearly, there's some structural aspects there that the provider is actually given an option at that point. And whenever we see options that aren't priced, we want to have great care. And if you look at, as we go through that Principle 17, we try to articulate exactly, you know, how hard it would be to be exercising that option in a way that would be supporting the overall principles of the code. And the likely part is right now, from talking to lots of market participants, we think likely that in most cases you cannot conform with the best practices there. However, we'd like to hear from the fullest range of providers, and I think Chris will talk about that, so we understand exactly with precision now around what those terms are. And what you'll also see, remember this is a global code, is the code has been written in English. All our meetings were in English. But we're going to see translations of the code in the major financial centers where, like Tokyo, we'll see it in India, for example. There will be translating the code. And that will allow local participants who don't necessarily use English when they're executing their FX to understand the principles fully.
And of course, we'll maybe come back to this point when we talk more in detail about the Global FX Committee and some of the new central bank members we have there. Now, Guy, let me come back to you for a moment. Could you talk us very briefly through of the main points of the material today that was released today? And perhaps if you could touch on the statement of commitment how you arrived to that piece of paper, which I have a copy of here. And we'll go to Chris after that to talk about adherence and the global FXC.
So what we've put out today is the complete code. As many of the people on the webinar might know, that we released phase one of the code almost 12 months to the day. But this is the complete code with all 55 principles. The areas which are covered in the complete code, which weren't there 12 months ago, are a lot of aspects around electronic execution, including the aforementioned last look, but also areas around prime broking, and also risk controls around electronic trading, in, you know, algorithmic trading in particular. So there's a section of the code on that in the risk management section. So as well as areas around governance, which weren't covered in the first part of the code. So as I said, this is the complete shebang. In the code as well, and that's something which is worth highlighting, is that we have the 55 principles. We also have quite a large number of examples illustrating the practical application of those principles, which I think comes to the point, it is principles-based, but it is useful to then, therefore, to illustrate what those principles are about by relating them to common market occurrences, both good and bad. So we have, you know, examples of behavior which is aligned with the code, and we have examples of behavior which clearly isn't aligned with the code. And actually, the process of going through all of those examples was actually quite beneficial in that we could come up with an example, and then various people could look at it, and then if it wasn't clear whether that was or was not good practice, then that suggested that we needed to refine the principle some. So I think those examples are quite helpful. So as I said, we've put out the code document. We've put out the document describing our principles, our blueprint for adherence. And alongside that, we've also put out a number of things. One is that a statement from the various foreign exchange committees endorsing the code, and also noting that in a number of cases they will link, most cases they will link membership of the foreign exchange committees to adherence to the code. There was a statement from the BIS governors endorsing the code, which, amongst other things, in notes that central banks themselves going to be adhering to the code, and also perhaps at least as importantly, so central banks will be leading by example, but they'll also be saying that we are also saying that we expect our counterparties to be to adhere to the code. So take my case from the Reserve Bank of Australia, we have it's not an expectation, it will be a requirement that our counterparties actually adhere to the code, which brings me on to the statement of commitment, which is the demonstration that you are adhering to the code. So statement of commitment in Annex 3 in the code. It's fairly short. It's about three sentences. It's signed by the institution that they their behaviour is aligned with the code. They have policies and procedures which ensure that is a case across the breadth of their engagement with the FX market. One point which is worth noting in that regard is the nature of your engagement does, you know, affect how much of the code is relevant to you, depending on what exact role you play in the market. So that statement of commitment is provided there for institutions, market participants to sign, including central banks.
And it's notable to add that there are already a number of institutions that are prepared to sign the statement of commitment immediately.
Yeah, we had a few this morning, actually, a number of institutions, platforms sending press releases that they have, technology companies as well.
That's really good news, yeah.
With, in terms of adherence, can we come to you, Chris, because you were the lucky person in charge of that bit. So in your blueprint for adherence, there is this process that you guys outline in terms of the statement of commitment. And then there is this whole idea of a public register, the GFXC looking after some of the elements. Could you give us an update on how fast you see this adherence process kind of lasting, or adoption of it lasting in the market? And also, if you could give us some ideas around what the GFXC will do in that regard.
Sure. So starting first with the blueprint that we published early today, that attempts to pull together our vision of the steps which is necessary to get widespread adoption to what is a voluntary code. And there are four central tenets around that. First, the code itself needs to be written in an appropriate manner, which engages on the issues of behaviour in the market, and we believe we've done that. The second key tenet is market participants have to take responsibility themselves to embed the code and then to demonstrate it, and this is where the statement of commitment comes in. First step is central banks will lead by example, and Guy talked about the ways that we'd do this. And fourth, that we need to have mechanisms to ensure that the code stays up to date in the future, and that is a responsibility of the Global Foreign Exchange Committee that met for the first time yesterday in its enlarged form and took upon itself that responsibility. I think in terms of initial steps, they are very much in terms of focusing on getting widespread adherence and adoption over the first year. I think our general hope would be that within 12 months, most firms should have had a chance to think about the code, consider if and how they need to document for themselves that they are following the principles set out in the code or whether they need to change any of their practices. So although some firms have been able to move very quickly because they've been part of this process and be able to assure themselves as of today that they can sign this statement, for most we think it's reasonable that some time frame from 6 to 12 months would be an appropriate period. One idea that is talked about in the blueprint, and we picked up specifically at the meeting yesterday, was as well as having individual statements of commitments, we need to have public registers where firms can post their statements. And I think one of the points which came across very strongly from the private market participants in yesterday's meeting was they see a real value in those public registers. So I think within 1, definitely 2 months, the Global FXC will publish some guidelines about what it thinks would make an effective public register. And I'm fairly confident that quickly after you put out those guidelines, firms will come forward and establish registers so that individual market participants can place their statement of commitments on these registers and make it easier for others to see.
But it's very much a private sector initiative that you expect to happen in terms of the public register. So you would like some private sector actor to come along and say, we will maintain this register, or an industry association. And also, with the public register, do you expect individuals to sign up, or do you envisage companies being on this?
So the statements of commitment are signed by companies. A company makes a statement that it is committed to the code. The public register enables those statements to be compiled. I think the view the GFXC came to is we can facilitate and encourage that. And we are considering creating a global index of public registers so you can go and see where all registers are. But then it'll be for private sector firms, associations, infrastructure providers to take the steps to establish registers. And the feedback we've got in the run-up to yesterday is that we are very confident a number of firms will step forward and take the initiative of creating a register. So I would imagine within 3 months there will be public registers that conform with the guidelines that the GFXC puts out within the next 2 months or so.
Thank you. David, let me come to you. You were running the private sector representatives group in this work. What do you think are the most important steps for market participants in the immediate wake of the code being published? And actually, we are getting quite a few questions in saying, where can we find a copy of the code?
Good.
I guess online is one place to look for it. Yes. The GFXC website?
Yes.
Perhaps? So that's www.gfxc.org.
Globalfxc.org.
There you go. There's a copy of the code. Sorry, David.
The code is now available to everyone around the world. I think the most important thing that we look to market participants to do today is to familiarize themselves with the contents of the code, identify areas where they may need to adjust practices and move as quickly as possible towards the signing of the statement of commitment. It is important to note that we released the first phase of the code a year ago, and many institutions have already embarked on a path of adjusting if that needed to be done. And as I said, there are even some very large and complex financial institutions that are prepared to sign the code today. So we feel that we're already well down the road. But the guidance to the market is read and understand the code, respond with questions or comments. But we feel, and this will be stated clearly, that the code is in its final form today.
And page 3 of the code, everyone should be looking at. And this is the wholesale market. If you're a market participant, that's defined as being in the wholesale market there, we're expecting those participants to read and understand the code.
Do you expect, the question, I guess, is for the panel, do you expect any differences in terms of the pace of the adoption on the sell side and the buy side, or depending on the size of the firms?
May I take just an early indication would be the answer is no. We're seeing a very positive response from all sectors of the market. There are buy-side firms that are prepared to sign today. As I said, there are complex financial institutions on the sell side. And as you highlighted, a number of platforms are already prepared to sign. So it will vary from institution to institution, but I think there's no industry standard that's going to be different from one over the other.
I think I would say one additional thing. Insofar as the buy side is a less concentrated and more diverse industry than the sell side, you may find that it takes slightly longer for all of that diversity and heterogeneity across the firms, for all of those different types to get to the point of signing the statements. But I can fully agree with David about, you know, what we expect, and we're confident about that.
I mean, the other thing I would note is that we are putting this thing out today. Various people have had opportunity, you know, particularly anyone engaged with the Foreign Exchange Committee process around the world, have had visibility over the text over the last few months, which has been in its pretty much final form over that period. But there are some people who are seeing this for the first time today, and you know that will take it, and it's appropriate that they take some time to read and digest and assess the implications of it.
A critical element of the code is proportionality, and there are certainly firms. One is not left to pick and choose that which they would like to follow, but instead identify those areas that are most appropriately aligned with their businesses and adjust accordingly. So the proportionality piece is very critical and will enable smaller firms to perhaps come on board more quickly than they might have otherwise believed.
What was the thinking behind the statement of commitment being a document that market participants can use in any way they like? So I think it was in the adherence blueprint that the statement of commitment can be used publicly. It can be used on a bilateral basis. You know, people can mail it to each other. What was the reasoning for making it so flexible rather than saying once you sign the statement of commitment, it's a public document?
So fundamentally, through developing the statement and putting it as an annex to the code, we've created a tool for market participants to use. This is a code for a global marketplace with many diverse participants. And rather than prescribing, it has to be used in a very individual or specific way, which may limit breadth. We wanted to create the statement and allow people to use it in a way which is appropriate for their business and their context. Now, my hope and expectation is most firms who sign the statement would want to then make that public somehow through their website or a public registrar. But we just don't know the context of every single firm out there which is a market participant as defined by the code. So it's a tool for firms to use. And the underlying point there is adherence is voluntary and it relies upon firms working out what is appropriate for them in their context. And this is something for them to use, but they have to make those judgments themselves.
We think the code in its entirety raises the bar for understanding across a broad marketplace of what is required and what is meant to be understood. And I think the voluntary nature of both taking on the code but also signing the statement of commitment, I think what it will do at a minimum is encourage all participants in the market to take a very hard look at what's been written here and to see those areas to which they apply.
So we've got questions coming in. Please keep sending them. Again, another kind of housekeeping point here. The blueprint for adherence is not an FCA document. It's not on the FCA website. There's a question asking why they can't find it on the FCA website. It is on the BIS website.
So it's not on the BIS website. This is actually the global FXC putting this out. I think that's somewhat important. But I also note this is a global code, and the FCA is a local regulator. So all the material is on the global FXC website in its entirety.
Albeit in a very important market.
Yes. No, that's right. I'm not wishing to, but as I said, this is a global initiative, not a local initiative.
Which is why it's not on the FCA website.
Implicit question about the FCA, they have put out a statement today which is very supportive of the code, and they have been very consistent throughout its development that they are supportive of this initiative.
And of course, the FCA already said that they might leverage the senior manager's regime in the UK.
That is absolutely right. I won't speak on behalf of the FCA, but they have drawn out previously that senior managers have a responsibility to ensure that their firms work in a way which is consistent with generally understood market practice. And this code is designed to codify generally understood good market practice in foreign exchange markets.
Now, I know that you're neither of you are regulators, but if people are worried about... they have found the global FXC website. If people are worried about regional discrepancies in terms of how regulators locally interpret or what tools they choose to leverage in their jurisdictions, are you able to give some reassurance or some guidance, or are you able to put market participants' mind at ease over this question?
Can I come in on this and make a couple of comments? There's a single code, but there are different regulatory contexts, and firms will need to understand how the relevant supervisors take account of the code in the market for which they have jurisdictional responsibility. What we can do for the Global Foreign Exchange Committee process, and what we will do through our annual or semi-annual meetings, is provide market participants the chance to discuss if there are any areas where actually interpretations of what was meant by a principle or some of the examples was unclear, and provide a mechanism for market to come together and work through any interpretive uncertainties that exist. Now, we think the code is as good as can be on day one of launch, but I'd be amazed if in a year's time we don't discover on a principle, I don't know which one it will be, but we do need to provide further guidance because this is now going out to a global marketplace. So that's what we can do for the GFXC process, but then firms need to understand their own particular regulatory environment.
Let's hope it's not going to be Principle 17 because we've talked about it a lot. We have a number of questions coming in, and one of them is a question about, it's from RBS. The question is, what are the implications of not signing the statement?
May I take a quick stab at that? The implications are only how you view your competitive position in the marketplace. I've said numerous times over the last 2 years, I believe that there's an increased level of ethical competition in the marketplace. And I would expect that firms that want to compete firmly will get behind the principles of the code. So it's a voluntary code. We have stressed that throughout. There's no stopping a firm from staying away from it. But I do think it may, over time, have business implications if one chooses not to sign the code.
I pick up on a couple of direct implications aligned with some of the other stuff which I mentioned earlier we've announced today. One, we said we as central banks have said that we will only deal with people who are adhering to the code. So if I take my own case, we're not a major foreign exchange market participant, but I'm guessing that the reputational effect of not being a counterparty of us may carry some weight. But more broadly, the central banking community as a whole have said this, that their expectation is that their counterparties will adhere to the code. Secondly, in terms of membership of foreign exchange committees, and again, I can speak from directly for the Australian FXC, which I'm the chair, is that we have that adherence to the code will be a requirement of membership. And I think there is some public demonstration effect there should one choose not to go down that route. So, but I would very much emphasize the point David made around, you know, that I think there is a reasonable chance that this is a competitive edge to actually say, yes, we are behaving appropriately in the market and we'll be, you know, treating our counterparties appropriately. I'm guessing that may well be actually good for business.
We actually did a quick ring around yesterday, just calling up platforms and banks and asking them whether clients or counterparties who don't sign this statement of commitment, whether they'll be turned off from platforms and single dealer platforms. I'm not sure that the thinking is quite as evolved on that as we expected it to be. So some people said that, you know, as a platform, this is not our role. Do you have any guidance you could give on how people should think about these questions?
I think it's very early. The code was released in its entirety this morning, and I think market participants need an opportunity to digest the information in the code and understand how it applies to their business. But I, again, we had the broadest cross-section of market participants that one could assemble weighing in on the principles that, which include many platforms, able to weigh in on the principles in the code. And I think we found broad-based support for the principles as they were worded. It doesn't mean that everyone will choose to sign it, but it does mean that we have some confidence about the acceptance of the code and how it will be put in practice.
I'd like to just step back a little bit. If you look at the start of the code, this code is intended to promote a robust, fair, liquid, open, and appropriately transparent market in which a diverse set of market participants supported by resilient infrastructure are able to confidently and effectively transact at competitive prices that reflect available market information in a manner that conforms to acceptable standards of behavior. That's the intention. We think that we met that. So I'd like to understand how we could improve the code so they could sign. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're saying it's not good enough to meet that. That's fine. If they're saying it's a lot of hard work, that's their choice, but it's not helping the FX industry as a whole if they're saying that. And the FX industry is critical to firms and households all over the world. It's the reason that we're all here to support that.
I suppose the other thing I would note is that David's market participants group put out something today, and if you look at the composition of that group, that covers a fairly large chunk of the market, whichever way you want to cut it, buy side, sell side, platforms, whatever. And they, maybe hand over to you to just explain what it is that was put out in that regard.
We put out a statement of intent that was signed by virtually all the participants in the market participants group, getting behind the code and committing not only to adopting it themselves, but also to encouraging others to do so. And I will, I have the honor of serving as the vice chair of the Global Foreign Exchange Committee for the next year. And I consider it my responsibility to represent the private sector in its entirety over the course of that time to ensure that I'm taking input and representing that community well. And I would certainly echo Simon's statements that if we find that there's a better way to do this, we will certainly work hard to make that happen.
And of course, you know, perhaps another point to make is that it's been made clear, very clear by the FX working group and I guess all of you guys that there is a three-year review, which is going to be a big comprehensive review. And I guess with the GFXC reporting it on that particular instance into the BIS Markets Committee, if the Markets Committee comes back and says, look, this is not good enough, what's going to happen then?
Well, I strongly hope we don't get into that situation. And I think it's important to pull out there are two different forms of review which will happen in 3 years' time. The GFXC will take a good look at the code in the entirety and ask ourselves the question, how does it need to be amended and changed to reflect changes in market structure? And the FX market structure will change over the next 3 years. We can't know how, but we do know it will change. It's a very dynamic market. And we'll do that in a much lighter touch way on an annual basis, but every 3 years we expect to do it on a heavy duty basis. And then you're right, in 3 years' time, the BIS governors have asked the Markets Committee, that Simon and I are both members of and Guy chaired until recently, to step back and ask whether the code is achieving the overarching aims that Simon read out earlier. If we conclude it's not, the governors will have to ask themselves the question, what other steps are needed to achieve those aims? And I'll leave them unsaid, but it's not hard to see where you might go at that point.
But let me also say, I mean, we've come up with something which we think, can I turn this around and make it positive? We actually have released something today which we think will achieve the aims that we've set out to do. Yeah. So I would, at least for the time being, on day one, like to emphasise that we actually expect this to work. And we think we've got a code which will achieve the aims that Simon read out earlier and are supported by the adherence mechanisms that Chris has articulated, which will help to achieve that.
And just adding, the exceptional nature of this public-private partnership, we have representation from 16 of the world's leading central banks who are behind this effort, and virtually hundreds of market participants from every different part of the wholesale industry working together on this. Our goal is to continue to improve. And so while the formal review will take place on an annual and then once again every 3 years, it will be a real-time review of adoption. While I don't expect we would make changes during that interim period, we will be watching very closely how it's adopted and how it's put into practice.
I think what we're hearing here, dear audience, is a central bank speak for a last chance saloon. So we've got a few questions, quite a lot of questions actually to get through. Who within the institution will be expected to sign the statement of commitment? Will it be the board, asks the Investment Association.
There is no prescription about who will sign it, and I think it will vary across firms, and in some cases it will be appropriate that the signatory comes from the board. In other cases, depending on the nature of FX within your particular firm, that would be an inappropriate distance between the reality of the FX business and the board. So the most senior individual who is accountable for the FX business would be my rule of thumb. Sometimes that will be a board member, sometimes it won't be. We did debate when drafting the code whether to be prescriptive in that way, and we concluded, and I think it's the right decision, not to put that in, because firms have different footprints and FX has different footprints within firms. But in some cases, yes, it should go to the board.
So I'm going to give you another example around that. Is if I'm a, a complex global institution which interfaces with the FX market in a number of different dimensions. So say I've got an FX desk or an FX business, but I've also got a custodial business and I've also got an asset management business. Now, I may decide that it's appropriate for that statement of commitment to be signed across the institution as a whole, or I may also, and be quite valid, to decide it's worth actually signing it across those three different lines because they have quite different interfaces with the foreign exchange market. So it's very much going to be depending on the circumstance of an individual firm.
And they should go through a process to decide who the appropriate person is, which was really underlying Chris's point. That helps them understand if they have the right compliance associated with trying to adhere to the code.
Okay. The adherence blueprint describes the development of public registers as one of a number of market-based initiatives to support the code. What other such initiatives can we expect? Joel Clark is asking.
The blueprint sets out our current thinking about the key steps to support adherence to the code. One other step we haven't talked about that the GFXC will take forward, which is not therefore strictly a market-based mechanism, but will support, I think, understanding about the breadth, penetration and help of the code, is an annual survey, both trying to assess the degree of awareness of the code, the extent to which firms are signing statements of commitment, expecting their counterparts to sign statement of commitment, and areas in which it is providing effective guidance. And we'll do that. We aim to do that on a first time round to provide a baseline survey sometime after September of this year and annually thereafter. I think implicit in one of David's answers, one of the things which we hope or could imagine seeing through time is counterparty expectations about the signing of statements of commitment to strengthen. And as David said early, I thought, and quite appropriately, this is early days for the market. But I think the combination of statements of commitment, public registers, and a general expectation could move to an equilibrium where it becomes an assumed part of business that you will have signed that statement of commitment. And if that happens, that would be a genuinely market-based mechanism, but that needs to be allowed to grow through time.
So to add on to what Chris just said, the buy side should be reading this.
Yep.
The buy side is critical to every transaction out there. So they should be understanding it and feel that they are getting services that conform with this code. That is going to be a very powerful market-based mechanism.
And the buy side has played a critical role in the development of the code from day one.
Isn't one of the as we talked about it at the introduction, this responsibility to understand, not just tick boxes. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that it's almost reinforcing this old idea of caveat emptor in the professional FX market?
No, in fact, I would say not, because you need to. So there's an you need to understand, that is true, but there's an expectation. What we are doing is setting standards of good behavior. that I don't regard as that's not what caveat emptor is about. Caveat emptor, one description is I can do whatever I want once we've entered an agreement. But that's exactly not what this is about. So I don't see it as aligned with that at all. We are, we are setting. I mean, to pick up on something Chris just said around the buy side is like now what we've got here is expectations that you can hold your counterparty to in a way that wouldn't have necessarily been true before because it wasn't entirely clear what good behaviour actually was. What we are trying to do is provide you with that understanding as to what you should be expecting. I said with caveat emptor, I would describe as you can expect anything. But what we're saying is, no, you've got to expect good behaviour. So I regard those things as not aligned. And it's not going back to that. It's actually taking it to a higher level than caveat emptor, which is says, what I should be expecting is this appropriate standard of behaviour for my counterparty.
And if I may just follow up on that, Ava, in terms of the phase one code, which was published last year, and it's unchanged in phase two, we spent quite a lot of time thinking about the roles and responsibilities of principals and agents. And principle eight of the code makes very clear, as an example, when the acceptance of an order grants the principal executing the order some discretion, it should exercise discretion reasonably fairly in such a way it's not designed or intended to disadvantage the client. And that's an example of what Guy is talking about, and that is infused across the code, that sense of obligation to treat fairly and not designed to disadvantage.
Thank you very much.
Transparency and ethical behaviour are, you will find throughout the document. And I think if we anchor ourselves to those two critical words, we will have a very successful outcome.
Now, David, I'm conscious that you will have to leave us soon, so I'll let me come to you with this question, and perhaps you could give us a little flavour of how global the MPG was. And Stefan Murray from ING Bank asking, how global is global? Will Russia and China support the FX Global Code?
Let me talk about formally and informally. I think we did our very best to work across as many jurisdictions as possible. So on my committee, we had representatives from Korea, from China, from India, from Mexico, from Brazil, from every major financial center around the world. And I want to stress that they were active participants. They were not there to represent their countries. They were there to represent the industry and did an exceptional job of doing so. And as I said earlier, the buy side, a broad cross-section of buy side participants to which we added at the completion of phase one, because we felt we would benefit from additional input to the code to ensure that we were both enabling and protecting all sections of the marketplace. And I do want to stress again, my role, particularly that I've had for the past 2 years and that I will continue for the next year, is to represent all sectors of the private side. This is not to represent solely the banks or the large asset managers, but to represent all participants in the market that would represent the private sector. I think we did a very solid job the first time, and I'm looking forward to what we'll be able to do over the course of the next year.
And then let me stay with you for another minute. As the vice chair of the Global FX Committee, there'll be some, you presumably will have looked at the private sector participants who will be on this GFXC list. Has it been decided yet?
The Global Foreign Exchange Committee is still one in formation. We met yesterday for the first time with pretty broad representation. That representation will continue to grow over the course of the next year.
Okay, and any final thoughts before you unfortunately have to leave us? Maybe you could tell us how you would describe your experience overall in the past 2 years in the MPG.
I can only describe it with the greatest amount of enthusiasm. And I will tell you that the group that I represented undertook this with a tremendous sense of responsibility, but also an opportunity to help what is truly the world's largest, most liquid marketplace grow ever stronger. And it's been a very positive experience and highlighted by what we've talked about throughout, the nature of the public-private partnership, one that is unprecedented in my experience of observing financial markets and covering the number of geographies and different participants who participated in with this group. It has been a truly honor to lead, and it's one that I'm, again, very, very excited about taking on for the next year.
Well, thank you very much. We will go to our holding slide for approximately 30 seconds to allow David to catch his flight, but we'll be back very shortly. Sorry, I will repeat the question. We have a question from Bridget Taylor. What is the continued process to include conduct expectations for other asset classes outside FX in the execution theme of the global conduct? Is that on the cards at all?
So in the UK context, one of the key recommendations coming out of the Fair and Effective Markets Review was the establishment of the FIC Market Standards Body that was established formally last year, run by Mark Yallop and Jerry Harvey. It has a membership now of over 40 firms operating in UK markets, both buy, sell side and infrastructural. And one of their key aims is to provide guidance to market participants around conduct across FIC markets. And that is what they are doing, and they are establishing a body of guidance through time. So that's a UK market specific response to that, but it is an example of market participants coming together to try and provide guidance about common understanding is a good practice.
Are there any similar initiatives, perhaps in the US, Australia?
So in the US, we have some other public-private partnerships like this one, and I think the information in the code is helpful for the Treasury Market Practices Group, just as some of the work the Treasury Market Practices Group was helpful in building this FX code. I make sure there's a good dialogue so people on the FXC, the TMPG are aware of the different work streams that they have. Information sharing is particularly one that I think the Global Code made some progress on, and you can see that coming out soon from the TMPG.
Right. So the FSB has a conduct work stream of which this what we're talking about here is very much aligned, and that is still ongoing.
Okay. We have a question about adoption again. So is the panel optimistic that the message that's in the blueprint for adoption will filter through to the buy side? For example, many asset managers don't even appear to know what last look is. I'd like to tack on to that question, my own question. The last look review, do you think that people understand the practice?
So can I answer the first question, then I'll let Chris answer your add-on. So one of our jobs going forward is actually to get the message out and through forums such as this one, to as broad an audience as possible. But to that point, though, one thing we have been doing over the last, particularly 6 months, is engaging with a wide range of industry associations, I think from last count, some 120 of them across the globe. And that covers those sections of the market. So again, if I speak for the Australian market, with which I'm most familiar, I have engaged with the Corporate Treasurers Association, and we'll be doing a webinar for them in a month or so's time on exactly this point. Okay. But also engaging with buy-side organisations. You mentioned IA earlier on for this market. So we've talked to them about getting the message out to their membership about what the code is and what it is about. And it also, I think, so it's important to propagate it out from that core from the core of the market to all parts of the market, both across the spectrum of the market, but also around the world. And it's beholden on all of us in particular and the MPG to get that message out either through counterparty relationships, but in whatever form. So I think there is a reasonably high degree of visibility now, but it's important to continue to push that forward. But let me turn to Chris to talk specifically around last look.
Sure. Just before I move on to last look on this visibility question, my sense is from the events I've done in London is that visibility and awareness of the code has grown through the process, and it was much greater at events I was doing March of this year than it was March of last year, and we need to continue. And actually, the associations that Guy was talking about, I think, have a responsibility to continue to grow awareness and promote awareness of the code to their members, so members can then make informed decision about adoption. In terms of last look, as Simon said in your kind of introductory questions, this was an area where there was significant debate and dialogue as we developed a code. And one of the benefits of that was to make people think very carefully about what they meant by the phrase last look. And Principle 17 does provide a clear definition of last look as a risk management tool. So I think the code may help provide a common understanding of what is terminology, which has probably been used in a kind of slightly broad brush set of ways to cover a broad brush set of practices. It's helpful at this point, I think, also to flag to webinar participants that one of the other outcomes of the GFXC meeting yesterday was a further consultation on last look practices, particularly on this issue that Simon talked about around 45 minutes ago around trading during the last look window. So if you go onto the GFXC.org website, we put up there this morning a consultation document seeking feedback upon two aspects of last look to do with trading in the last look window. And I'd encourage everyone on the webinar to go and download that document. And if they want to provide feedback, there's a web address and they have until the 21st of September to do so.
21st of September is the deadline for feedback on last look.
In a PDF format.
In a PDF format. Please stick to the format. Right, so we have corporate firms. We have a question about corporates, and I know that, Guy, you mentioned a webinar, but I suppose they are an important part of the market. What about corporate firms? Are they aware of the code, and who will train them in good practices?
So, I mean, we had a couple of corporates on our group who are incredibly engaged and contributed a hell of a lot to the process. But one of the things, and it comes back to something I said earlier, I think we emphasise the proportionality. So a lot of what's in here is not directly relevant for the corporate in the terms of their own business. Mm-hmm. But what it does provide them with, which I mentioned earlier, is the standards that they can expect from their counterparties. And I would say for the corporate audience, that's the most useful aspect of this document, is more what can I expect from my counterparty, particularly if my engagement with the market is infrequent and I'm not in there all the time. This is what I should be expecting to see from the behaviour of my counterparties. I think that's probably of most use to the corporates. And so in doing events like the one I mentioned earlier, it's very much getting out there to them that you should look on this as a sort of how-to guide. Well, not so much a how-to, but this is the expectations you should be holding your counterparties to in a way that is information which I don't think was so available to them before. So if you're a corporate, on the other hand, who's in the market all the time and you're executing, your treasury is executing all the time, then more of this is going to be relevant for you than if you're someone who's only in there on an agency basis, sporadically.
And I guess it triggers conversations.
Yes. And one of the things David mentioned earlier, it sounds slightly trite, but actually the conversations that have been had over the course of this, I think, have actually been invaluable in getting in developing that common understanding as to what constitutes good behaviour, rather than writing something in a sort of more unilateral way. I think it allows us to have a little more confidence that this is something which will work for the market as a whole.
Okay. I'd like to touch on prime brokerage just briefly, because that's an area that was covered in the second phase. But in the end, there is no prime brokerage section, I guess. Prime brokerage principles are scattered around in the various sections. Why was that decision made?
So I think that the way we structured it for that particular service, we wanted to distribute that across the lead principles and not separate it out. We did something similar for interdealer brokers. There's a small section there. But throughout, if you look at the execution part, I think there's some clarity where you need it for prime brokerage on risk management compliance in the same way, and also confirmation and settlement. But definitely this was an area, I think, if you look at what FXCs have done in the past, We felt it was important to give individual guidance around the appropriate use of prime brokerage. With this fuller code, I think it fits neatly in the parts that we put it in, and there was no need to separate it out.
Okay. Just another point on third-party technology providers, connectivity providers, liquidity aggregators, white-label solutions. Should they be looking at the code?
Yes.
Yeah.
Will they be affected by their customers perhaps changing their business practices? And whose responsibility is it in the end if, say, a bank or a buy-sider uses a third-party vendor?
Well, I mean, again, it all depends on the exact nature of your engagement with the market as to how it is relevant. If you're an aggregator, you have a form of engagement with them, with your counterparties, for which various sections of this, I would certainly think in the aggregator section that I mentioned earlier around the risk management and compliance area, there's a fairly large electronic chunk of that. I'm guessing that would be pretty relevant to your business. But also aspects of the execution as well, and partly picking up on the PB side of things. I mean, as you said, that sometimes response. I mean, ultimately, I think anyone is responsible if you have some role in any of those steps, and so you should be looking at that, looking at this, and working out how exactly that applies to your particular aspect of your engagement with the market. But yes, those participants you were talking about are very much market participants in the wholesale FX market, and so they should be looking at this and being able to work out. It should be reasonably clear how this applies to their engagement with the FX market.
What's been behind those two questions really is how dynamic the market is, the form of execution can change. It is definitely the leading edge of introducing technology in, you know, the over-the-counter market. And what we have to make sure is the code going forward keeps up with that dynamic. And the formation of the global FXC with its diversity of countries and market participants will really help us do that.
Okay, we're fast running out of time, so we have time maybe for one or two questions. How can you ensure market makers, both banks and non-banks, adhere to what they state within their client disclosure letters? Chris, maybe we'll come to you for this one.
Well, I think firms have a responsibility to abide by their client disclosure letters. Or put in, you could rephrase your question in a different way. How can we be confident that firms will act in a way which is consistent with the code when they signed a statement of commitment? And the answer to that is the firms have a responsibility to have systems and controls in place and training of their staff so they're confident that they do what they say they're going to do. And that's a responsibility of firms' senior management.
Systems and controls have been a problem before, so they're very important to keep an eye on those. And we have one final question, perhaps, from the audience. From Australia. Can you please outline the role slash input that regulators from around the world have had in the creation of the code?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, again, I can maybe talk from my jurisdiction that we're certainly, in my case, our securities regulator has had an opportunity to look at it and they're comfortable with it. We've been mindful as we're, and moreover, they're more than comfortable with it, and picking up on something Chris said. In Australia, the securities regulator, ASIC, has said that they will use the code as their guidebook, I suppose, for their surveillance of the FX market, wholesale FX market in Australia. They said that last week. And so they're comfortable with this and to the point of actually using it in their oversight of the FX market.
So it's almost like a framework to base their penalty system on?
Surveillance system on.
Surveillance system, yes.
You don't always have to direct penalties. But the other point I'd note is that we have been mindful in the course of drafting this to ensure that, as best as we can, that it is consistent with the various and often quite diverse regulatory frameworks that exist across the jurisdictions that have been involved here. So we make it very clear that this is to be read in conjunction with those regulations. But at the same time, we're fairly confident, very confident, I would say, that nothing we've got here is inconsistent with regulatory practices in any of the jurisdictions that involved, and notwithstanding the vast diversity of them.
Did you have a lot of input from regulators, or were they more just monitoring the process, you know, keeping, making sure that there were no...
I mean, again, there was somewhat on a more country-by-country basis, so I can only speak in my case. There was, you know, there was interaction to make sure that they were comfortable with what was being put out.
In the case of the UK, it would be no surprise to anyone that we did indeed consult closely with the FCA as the code developed, and were aware of their perspectives on the code. Given the remediation programme they'd gone through 2 years ago, anything else would have been the wrong answer. But the code, in the end, was put together through this public-private partnership between the central banks and the market participants that we worked with, and we are that group responsible for the code which has been published.
And just again, to bring things to an end, the code can be found at www.globalfxc.org/docs. Someone helpfully, who was earlier looking for it, said, "I found it. Here it is."
Just let me point out there are a few other ways you can find it, which is each foreign exchange committee in each jurisdiction has material on this, which will link you directly to the code. So I really don't think it shouldn't be too challenging for people to locate it. There's any number of directions one can access it from. But as you said, the best place to do is to go to that website, globalfxc.org, and there's all the suite of materials and relevant information on that in the one-stop shop.
And the code is designed for ease of use, so just start clicking on it and see what happens.
Or, if you still can't find it, call your counterparty. Ask who they have one.
Excellent.
I'm afraid we have to come to an end here. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much to our panel for joining us. I hope the code will gain traction, you'll sleep better, and you won't have to wake up saying that this is not regulation but principles anymore. And on that note, thank you for listening. The webinar will be available to view as recorded. After we finish, if you just go to the registration page, register as before, you'll be able to watch the whole session. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great day.